You're listening to Jefferson Public Radio. I am Eric Thiel and thrilled to welcome to the JPR studios singer-songwriter Chris Smither. Chris, welcome to Jefferson Public Radio.
Thanks, Eric. Good to see you.
You had a bit of a vagabond upbringing. Spent some time in New Orleans. You spent some time out of the country. You studied abroad. Mm-hmm. What was that period like for you? Was it chaotic or did it just feel like the natural thing?
It didn't seem, you know, it's only in retrospect that it seems, you know, chaotic or peripatetic. Like you, I think of myself as being from New Orleans. That's where I lived in New Orleans from the time I was about 2 until I was 22. That was home. Mm-hmm. And then there were these excursions, you know, out to other places. But, sometimes it was the whole family that went, you know, but we always came back to New Orleans, you know. I didn't think of it as particularly abnormal. It was just, that was just the way it was, you know.
When you were on the travels to different cities or different countries, were you exploring the music of those cultures at the time, or was that not yet really
that wasn't
worldview?
Really a big deal yet. You know, I was the first really big jump that I remember was when I was like 11 and 12, and we went and lived in Paris for almost 2 years, and that was when I first really started playing the guitar. I'd been playing a ukulele until I got found when I was 9 years old, and I had an uncle that showed me 3 chords on it, and he famously told me, he said, listen, with 3 chords you can play almost any song you know, and if you know 4 chords you can rule the world. So I said, that's cool, you know. But my father bought me a guitar that year. It was a total surprise to me, but you know, he got me a guitar, and that was the end of my life, as far as he was concerned. he spent years regretting it, but he finally came around, you know. But it was just a passion that endured. It's the only thing in my whole life, you know, that I ever picked up at a young age and just stuck with the whole time. You know, I was inseparable from the guitar. But in terms of exploring the music, you know, I was an American in 1956 in Europe, and American music was dominating the world. It was beginning this domination of the entire world, and so I didn't really listen to anything else. You know, I was, you know, one of the main reasons I got into blues was because it was one man rock and roll. To me, I heard Lightnin' Hopkins, and I didn't hear blues. I heard one guy doing what sounded like rock and roll to me. Yeah. You know.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about what you do, but mm-hmm. let's hear a tune first.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. tell them they'll know as soon as you do. The inside out is my direction. Red and white don't matter, that's for sure. Oh, come on, baby, feel that infection. I'm your cure. Cause if you get no satisfaction, you can always go back home again. But if you never check out this action, you will always wonder just what might have been. Let's step out now, cool and steadily. Keep your head up, don't be shy. Oh, come on, baby, I think you're ready.
Don't Call Me Stranger, performed live by Chris Smither here on Jefferson Public Radio. You are often referred to as a folk blues singer-songwriter or a bluesy folk singer-songwriter. Does one of those labels feel right to you? Do you think of yourself as a blues musician first and foremost?
I think of myself really as a songwriter. You know, singer, what they call singer-songwriter would be an accurate description, and that's how I think of myself. Although when I first started doing this for a living, I was playing an awful lot of blues. I mean, that was where I got my education, you know, in sort of in pop song. I mean, blues was the pop song of the 20s, you know. I listened and copied assiduously all the masters, you know, John Hurt, Mississippi John Hurt, Skip James, Robert Johnson, Lightning Hopkins, all those guys, you know, I was sitting at their knee, you know, figuratively speaking, and then I started writing songs. But, you know, I've often said, and it's still true, it's very much like Dylan. You know, Dylan started listening. I mean, Dylan's first record, he was doing Blind Willie McTell songs. And then when he started writing songs, it's very obvious where he went to school in terms of music. You know, it's exactly the same sort of pattern that I followed.
And there's a sense of that blues structure both in the songs that you write, but also to a large degree in the way you perform them, both your guitar style, you know, the finger picking style, but also this technique that you have developed over the years with your feet. And during that tune, you know, one of the things that becomes readily apparent is that there's a lot more going on than just singing and guitar playing. Tell me a little bit about how you got started incorporating foot tapping into your music.
Well, it was more a question of when did I discover that it was important. You know, it's something I've always done, and I can't play without. I mean, if you hold my feet down to the ground, I can't play guitar. it's a very strange sensation. in my first records, you know, my producers used to say, "Don't tap your feet. Let the drummer do that." You know, and I can't play. If I can't tap my feet, I can't play.
So you've embellished that, right? I mean, you actually have brought
in a way. You know, it's funny. I think I have. I mean, it's essentially about 20 years ago. I just, you know, when I was undergoing some major shifts in my whole career, my whole approach to performing, and I had a manager, and I suddenly realized that if I couldn't hear my feet, if there was carpeting on the floor, then I couldn't play as well. I used to wonder why it was that sometimes I'd be in the dressing room warming up for a show and everything would feel great. It was going to be great. And then I'd go out on stage and it would all fall apart. And it took me so long to realize that it was because the stage was carpeted and it didn't have that same feel.
So you bring your own flooring.
So yeah, my manager said, you know, my new manager said, you know, well, let's make sure that you can hear it. In fact, she said, let's make sure that the audience can hear it. Cause if it's important to you, it's probably important to anybody that's listening. And so that's when we started miking the feet and making sure that people could hear what was going on. And it really, you know, without even being consciously aware of it, there's all sorts of unstated rhythms that go on in the feet. There's, if you hear me without hearing the feet, it sounds strangely empty, and, mm-hmm. and there's these sort of holes, these lacuna in the overall sound. Some people actually think I'm playing a lot more guitar than I am because they unconsciously they don't, without even realizing it, they hear the feet, and it's almost like they're a unit, you know, they makes it for a full sound.
So when you started doing it and started incorporating it in your performances, it was just simply miking something that you had been doing all along.
That's right.
Was there a point at which you started thinking about it as being an additional instrument for you?
I try not to think about it too much, you know. It's an unconscious thing, and I almost feel like if I actually worked at it, it would get sort of gimmicky, you know. I just rather have it be the way it is that I feel it, you know. And for the most part, it's pretty recognizable. I mean, I play 95% of the time in 4/4 time, so usually there's the left foot is fours and the right foot is twos.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it sounds like. But sometimes I get into this thing if I'm playing in three, and I don't do that very much, where I'll play twos in the left foot and threes in the right foot. So that sounds like this. Let's see.
Well, let's hear another tune.
Yeah, sure. from behind. But I once was fast, back in the distant past, in a mighty demonstration of my will. I kissed her twice at the speed of light. Time stood still. I kissed her twice at the speed of light. Time stood still.
Time Stands Still, the title track from the latest album of Chris Smither, my guest live here on Jefferson Public Radio. Chris, I notice a lot of songwriters are dedicated to only recording their own tunes. But yeah. Something that you've done over the years is you've often incorporated other writers' songs in not only performances, but in your albums.
Yeah. It's easier than writing them, for one thing. But, you know, it's a statement, and it's also a not only do I like the songs. I mean, I wouldn't do a song if I didn't like it. But I like to show people sort of where I live in the musical world. You know, these are people that I listen to. You know, and it's also in a not so subtle way, it's a statement of saying I think my stuff's as good as this stuff. You know, I think when I was younger, that was an attitude that I had, and strangely, it's an attitude that's sort of contrary to what most of the younger writers and you know that phenomenon of not playing anything but your own tunes is principally a young musician and a young writer's stance, because for one thing, they're reluctant to be compared to anybody, you know, and they're reluctant to acknowledge influences. You know, I was that way too. You know, you don't until I realized it was really silly, because you know, you wear your influences on your sleeve. They're obvious to anybody that's been listening to music, and so it's kind of pointless to try and hide them. But you know, I think people actually like it. I think the audience really enjoys it, especially if you can bring something to a song that nobody had noticed before, you know, because all those things live in those songs, you know. It's just that they haven't been presented in a way that brings out that aspect of the song. So if you can do that, then there's a creative aspect to it that has to be acknowledged as well.
Yeah. Your music kind of falls in between those valleys, you know, between folk and blues and singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And writers are always trying to compare you or likening your music to other people. What's the comparison that you've heard that has come for you straight out of left field that was just completely unexpected?
None of them, to tell you the truth. I don't think, you know, I see the... it could be that there's been one or two that I thought were really strange, and so I just sort of forgot about them. I didn't want to think about that. But, you know, I get comparisons to Dylan. I get comparisons. Leonard Cohen is one that pops up a lot, you know, and I think it's just because, you know, lyrically speaking, he tends to focus on big questions, and then that's, you know, kind of what I get into as well. You know, there's a bunch of them, and I usually can see the validity. J.J. Cale, that's another one, but that's because he's sort of a belt buckle kind of music guy. You know, that's
belt buckle music.
Well, there's a funny way of when you're standing up and listening to songs. There's a certain way that you sway to certain rhythms. And if it centers on your belt buckle, that's belt buckle music.
Well, you've been doing this now over 40 years, and I think you've got 11 albums.
11 studio records plus a couple of live ones.
Yeah. Which is, one way of looking at that is that's not a ton of recorded output over 40 years.
No.
But I've read that you talk a lot about enjoying performing.
Yeah.
At least in the past, enjoying performing better than recording. Is that still true?
Well, not as much as it used to be, because it used to be, you know, recording used to be a chore to me now, and now I really enjoy it. I've had a couple of producers who have taught me how to have fun in the studio, and also there's a degree of confidence that comes with having done it a lot. At this point, I don't feel nervous. In my first few records, I always felt, you know, it was like final exam time. Now they find out how much I don't know, you know. You know, but you know, now I go into the studio and realizing that with a better grip on the kind of state of mind I have to be in, and also an idea of how to promote that state of mind so that I go in, you know, feeling eager. And I've found some people that I really like working with, and so it's usually pretty much a party. You know?
I find it interesting that the new album, despite how you perform and mm-hmm. construct your songs, the new album's a trio album.
Yeah.
What does that allow you to do musically that you're not able to do when you're solo?
Well, nothing really. I mean, that's not true either. You know, it allows for some arrangements. In a way, I feel production on records is important simply because you miss the visual aspect. If somebody comes and hears me live, they say, well, I like you just by yourself. But that's to a large extent because they're sitting there looking at me. They're watching me. And they often don't even realize how much of the actual physical presence that they're watching adds to the performance. You know, to be able to see the feet going, to be able to see facial expressions. Now, I'm not aware of that, but they are. Because they tell me all the time, you know. And I, in a way, I think that arrangements on a record make up for that, for what's missing, you know. They make up for what you don't get on just an audio recording. It's a chance to play with some really good players. You know, it's just one of those things. You know, I can't afford to bring a band. If I could bring a band of the kind of players I like with me on the road all the time, I might do it more often. You know, but the kind of people that I like to play with make a lot of money.
You mentioned playing other people's music and acknowledging their talents, and the same can be said of your songs. Your songs have been covered by quite a few people over the years. Uh-huh. Emmylou Harris has covered one, and perhaps the song of yours that has had the most life to it is "Love Me Like a Man."
Right.
I know you and Bonnie Raitt have been friends for a long time, and she recorded that tune for I think her second album back in the early 1970s, and it has gone on to be quite a big hit for her, and it's something that kind of caps most of her live performances. In fact, she just played at our theater in Reading last week. Uh-huh. But as I understand, that album was not a huge hit at the time. I mean, she became popular 15 years later.
Yes.
What has that song done for you with her attention given it?
Oh, it'd be very hard. It would be very hard to overstate how much that's done for me. It's one of those. It's one of those gifts that just keeps giving. Mm-hmm. You know, that as a result of her recording that song has been recorded by at least 15 different artists, most notably by Diana Krall,
and just it's "Girl in the Other Room" album,
right? Yeah. And just from a financial standpoint, it's almost, I mean, you know, not only did Bonnie record it in the 70s, it was included on a greatest hits record, you know, long after she became, an enormous star and was selling millions of records. And so, you know, you may only get 7 cents a copy, but, you know, when there's millions of 7 cents, they really add up, you know. So it, between the two of them, Diana Krall and Bonnie, you know, I not only paid the mortgage for years when I wasn't doing so well, got my teeth fixed, I have a nice little account for my daughter's education. You know, those sorts of things, publishing and songwriting, when they pay very well. And it's very, I'm just grateful, you know. And the other thing about that song is that it's become a blues standard. You know, you cannot go, I say this in all modesty, you cannot go find a blues band anywhere with a girl singer who does not know that song. They play it and they sing it every time, and it's a thrill to me every time I hear it. I go in and say, wow, okay, if I die tomorrow, at least there's that one.
Is that song still in your
I played it last night.
Do you find this many years now removed from when you first wrote it and having heard those different versions other people have recorded, do you find yourself looking or approaching that song differently than what you did?
No, I still play it the same way. It's a guy's song, the way I do it. The way they do it, it's a woman's song, but I do it as a guy's song. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Let's see. I got to take a deep breath here. I wrote this when I was 23. it tires me out now.
Balls up on the shelves, and you know they could never love you, baby. They can't even love themselves. You need someone who can, and I could be, I bet I could be your lover, man. You better believe me when I tell you I love you like a man. Cause I never seen such losers. I bet you never tried find a man that could take you home, never taking you for a ride. If you need someone who can, I could be, I bet I could be your lover, man. Come on, believe me when I tell you I love you like a man. Some fool ask you why. If you need someone who can, I could be, I bet I could be your lover, man. Come on, believe me when I tell you I love you like a man. Cause they all want you to rock them just like their back ain't got no bone. What you need is a man that can rock you like your backbone was his own. You need someone who can, and I could be, I bet I could be your lover, man. Come on, believe me when I tell you I love you like a man. Cause all these men that you've been seeing, they got their balls up on the shelf. They could never love you, baby. They can't even love themselves. You need someone who can. I could be, I bet I think I know I could be your lover, man. Believe me when I tell you I love you like I love you. Love you like I love you like a man.
It's Chris Smither live on Jefferson Public Radio. Chris, so much fun to watch and hear you perform. It's just great. So grateful that you stopped by to play for us today. You recently wrote a column for the New York Times about being a frequent flyer and traveling all over.
That's a feature that they put every weekend, you know, a frequent flyer in the business section of the New York Times. Yeah.
How did that article come about, and what was the gist of the article?
Well, you know, the piece, it's a feature that comes out every week. You know, it's written by, it's a conversation with a woman, you know, just, and they just pick somebody to profile who spends a lot of time in airplanes, you know. It's a subject of constant interest to people who do it for a living. And I think my manager and my publicist both, they both read the New York Times every day. they were looking at it, and my publicist said, God, you know, Chris has flown millions of miles, you know. We should, you know, get him, or I think actually my manager said we should get him, you know, look at this. This is the New York Times. This is a national publication.
Yeah.
And you get a whole feature like this plus a picture, you know. And so they called, and it was very interesting. I was sort of semi-kept abreast of this, you know, but they just asked me if I'd be interested in doing it, if they got it. And I said, sure, you know, what is this, talk to somebody for half an hour? It was more involved than you might think. You know, they called, my publicist called the woman who does the piece, and she informed my publicist that she gets like 150 requests every week, you know, for this, something like that, an enormous number of people. And she's got it down to a science. She says, submit me a proposal with like bullet points of little stories, you know, that have happened to you, you know, on airplanes, things you have to say about it, if you're familiar with the column. And so we did. And she called right back and she said, I want to do this. You know, let me talk to him. and we had the conversation. It was just a telephone conversation and for probably lasted a half an hour. And she's a wonderful person to talk to. As you might imagine, she's very engaging and, you know, she sort of draws these stories out of you. And
now, a couple of years ago, you wrote another column that was, a public service to the professional guitarist community.
Right.
That was in Acoustic Guitar. Uh-huh. About the perils and the protocol, I guess, of traveling on planes with a guitar.
With a guitar. How to avoid checking the guitar.
If you have spent any time playing a guitar or traveling with a guitar or are a budding or a professional musician, this is an article that is well worth reading because you lay out all sorts of tips and tricks for just getting around and protecting this important piece of you.
Right. Yeah. The gist of the article, the main thrust of the article, at least what I intended for it to be, was not really tricks and not trying really to deceive anybody, but ways of working within the framework of the airlines and understanding, trying to help people understand how the personnel on the airline looks at it. You know, it's a question of not being obvious, of just giving the appearance and the impression of somebody who's just trying to get their jobs done. And that's all the people, that's all the crew is trying to do too. They're not trying to, you know, make your life miserable, you know, intentionally. You know, that gives yourself way too much credit in there. Yeah. They don't have time to do that, you know, but there are ways that you can make it less obvious, and that's all there is to it. And I finally got some feedback once. I was standing in a men's room, as a matter of fact, next to this, to another fellow at the marble wall, so to speak, you know, and I could feel him look over at me, and he said, Chris Smither, and I said, here we go. And he says, I've wanted to talk to you. He says, I've worked for the airlines for 20 years, and I've played guitar for 20 years. And he says, I saw that piece that you did in Acoustic Guitar, and I have shown it to every flight crew I've worked with. The guy said, here's a guy who understands. You know, and that's really what I was trying to do, was get it to the point all you have to do is just understand the point of view from the other side, and then you'll find it much easier to get on with your guitar.
And that article, by the way, is archived on Acoustic Guitar's website. You can read it. Okay. Speaking of literary connections to what you do, tell me about Linda Barnes.
Oh, Linda. You know, I first met Linda and her husband, Richard, when they used to be – well, she's a good guitar player in the first place, you know, as well as writing a detective series, you know, a mystery series. She used to come down to all the coffee houses that I played when I was in my 20s in Boston. And she and her husband were both aficionados of that kind of music. And they would they listened to it. And she was a high school English teacher, you know, at the time. But and very nice people. And they, friends of friends and so forth. And then I sort of lost touch with them for a few years. But I knew that she'd started writing detective stories, you know. And then she... After her first three stories, I think, her first three novels, she developed the enduring character of Carlotta Carlyle, her investigator in the series. And I was in the first book. She mentioned me in the first book. And the first book did really well, and she decided that I was her good luck talisman. And I have been mentioned in every single one ever since. I think there's like 14 or 15 books in the series now.
Do you have a set of your own?
Oh, I do indeed, signed, every one of them.
You know, speaking of writing, a lot of artists write at least one or two songs that revolve around kids, mm-hmm. or around children. Often that comes around the beginning of parenthood. And sometimes... To be fair, some of those songs end up being a little cheesy or a little silly.
Mm-hmm.
You have written a beautiful song that revolves around the childlike mind that I'm assuming came about, at least the idea came about as a result of parenthood for you.
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean,
was there a real story behind that song?
Well, yeah, there is a real story. I became a parent very late. You know, I was 60 when we went to China and adopted this little girl. And
what's her name?
Robin. And we had an education live, as all parents do, you know, no rehearsal, no instruction manual. You sit there and try to learn how to be a parent and try to keep yourself together, at least in the eyes of the child. But, you know, I'd had this little melody running through my head, you know, and something that I noodled around on the guitar for years. And I started writing this song, and it was lucky that it happened right in the middle of a songwriting batch, because I was, you know, all your muscles, your songwriting muscles are in good tone, and, you know, it happened fast. And I finished the whole song in less than 2 days, I think, a day and a half, something like that. And I was very, very pleased with it. You know, it was just one of those things that, and it's been a big hit, you know, with my audiences. You know, there's a certain, well, most people come up and say, it's a charming song without being corny.
Exactly. You know, and, was there a real conversation that
started
there
were
that?
Several. Yeah. There were several. You know,
so it's been stitched together.
Oh, yeah, it has been, you know. But I have, and my wife also has a notebook. I have a notebook, and my wife has a notebook, and we make little, when she says things, you know, she says these little things, and I write them down because they're... they're funny, you know. It's just, and they're interesting and they're intriguing, because it's nice to hear somebody's take on a situation that you've lived with your whole life, but they're not into a thinking rut about it. You know, they have an original way of expressing it. So,
and those conversations ended up as I don't know,
as a song called I Don't Know.
Can we finish today with that?
Sure. Okay. Here we go. Daytime go when I'm asleep at night, to the other side of the world, they're all in the light. But how do they sleep at all if they've got sunshine in their eyes? They don't, they go to bed about the time you rise. If they sleep while I'm awake, when do we talk to them? What time do they eat? How do we know? Cause if today here is tomorrow there, can that be so? I don't know. Were you as big as you are now when I was born? I've been this big a long time, that's why my face is worn. Yes, but were you ever little? If so, where was I? Yes, I was, but you weren't anywhere or anywhere. But how could I be nowhere if I'm here today? Nothing is just nothing. So who showed me the way? And if something comes from nothing, then what makes it grow? I don't know. Them all, though some will say they do. If they try to fool me, then what should I say? You know, if you're just polite, they usually go away. What's the dumbest question that ever there could be? The only dumb ones are the ones that you don't ask of me. And the wisest dance is one you learned a long time ago. I don't know. Yeah, the wisest dance is one you learned a long time ago. I don't know.
It's Chris Smither live on Jefferson Public Radio with I Don't Know from the newest release, Time Stand Still. You are traveling back through this area, as I understand, in a couple of months.
Yeah.
In a rather creative and interesting tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's a train tour.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with this, and where is the route?
Charlie Hunter, who was actually a part of my management team for years, is a train buff. And after he got out of the management business, he started doing promotions of these folk trains or music trains, you know, and you know, for a, actually what amounts to a good chunk of money. You can buy a seat on this train, and what happens is that, you know, for anywhere from 3 to 5 days, you know, you travel through beautiful scenic countryside with 3 or 4 really top-notch singers and songwriters doing workshops and stopping at various places along the way to do concerts, you know. And of course, if you're on the train, you get into the concert free. You got an all-access pass, you know. It's all, you know, it's a great hang, you know. And I've heard many reports of them and seen lots of pictures from others, but I have never participated in one. This is my first, you know, although I've been aware of them for a good 15 years or something like that.
And it's Peter Case, Dave mm-hmm. Alvin, Rick Shea, Lori Lewis, Nina Gerber, and you.
And Chris Miller, yeah.
It launches from L.A.?
Launches from L.A., goes up to Portland, turns around, goes back to L.A., yeah.
Cool. And there are not that many spaces, I guess, on the train. It's
I don't
like,
know.
I think
I
it's like
know.
50 people. So
really?
There's there's information on your website
yeah.
with a link to how to sort of sign up if you're interested in that.
Right. I'm sort of going into it, you know, with a fresh mind. I'm trying not to load up too much information, you know.
You're going for the train ride, aren't you?
That's right.
Chris Smither, thank you so much for stopping by Jefferson.
It's a pleasure. Day.